Thank you for coming. So as you heard, my emphasis is bringing traditional practices into secular settings at the university, in hospitals, often at scientific meetings, and also scientifically studying some of these traditional practices. So the name of tonight's talk, if you saw, is Idiot Compassion and Wise Compassion. How many of you have heard that term before, idiot compassion? Oh, yeah, and you probably heard it from me, right? Okay, great. Well, let me introduce this idea, because sometimes it's a little bit offensive in the beginning. Are you calling me an idiot? This is a term that I learned from Acharya Pema Chodron, who's a Tibetan Buddhist teacher, and she learned it from her teacher, Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, and he used the word idiot compassion to describe those unfortunate situations where we are motivated by compassion, yet find ourselves acting in a way that further contributes to suffering in the world, either because we are confused about the meaning of compassion or about what is required in a specific situation to offer compassion. And a really easy example of this is to imagine a drug addict who is going through withdrawal. And perhaps this addict has expressed a desire to become free from this addiction. But in the moment now, as he or she is going through withdrawal, is really suffering the physical and the psychological effects of that withdrawal. And in that moment, a kind of idiot compassion response would be to freak out about the suffering that's happening, to see the physical pain and the psychological distress, and say, okay, I better buy this person some drugs, help them shoot up so we can relieve the suffering in the situation. Because I can't stand to see their distress. And when they're distressed, it brings up in me so many difficult feelings and discomfort that I need to escape that myself. So I'm going to give them whatever it is they think they want in this moment, whether or not that actually is going to contribute to the reduction of suffering in the long run. So that's a kind of classic example of idiot compassion. And I'm going to talk tonight about many different ways that how we misunderstand compassion or what compassion requires of us can lead us astray in our practice or even keep us from the practices that help us cultivate compassion and related qualities like loving kindness and equanimity and sympathetic joy. And when we talk about idiot compassion, another sort of framework I like to think about is how easy it is for us to come to practice with the best of intentions, and yet somewhere along the way, our own conditioning, our ego, or self-critic can get in there and run the show in a way that only further strengthens our suffering rather than helping us become free from suffering. And I think of this sort of like near beer. Are any of you remember near beer? We don't have to talk about that in Buddhist settings, but near beer was advertised. It looks like beer. It smells like beer. It tastes like beer. But it's missing one key ingredient, so it's probably not going to have the same effect on your mind as actual beer. And in my experience, a lot of us can fall into what I would call near practice, where it looks like we're meditating, sounds like we're meditating, it kind of feels like we're meditating. But because of these confusions, the idiot confusions around suffering and how to become free from suffering, our practice is just reinforcing that suffering. So whether or not you're particularly interested in compassion practices and cultivating compassion, I hope that this conversation tonight will also just illuminate a little bit that process of how easy it is to let conditioning run the show and how important it is to get some space between what's going on related to conditioning or the inner critic or the ego when we're practicing. And we all have an idiot inside of our head. It's not that some of us are idiots about this stuff and others are compassion geniuses or prodigies. Sometimes the wisdom in our practice comes from just disidentifying a little bit, learning to recognize what that voice of the idiot is. Okay, so, and one thing you'll notice, by the way, is I'm going to probably refer to my notes every now and then so that I don't give you the idiot version of this talk. We'll look for at least one little pearl of wisdom in there. Okay, so I mentioned the classic form of idiot compassion that you often hear described, of enabling somebody else's suffering because we ourselves are so distressed or guilty in this moment. Let me just give them money so I can escape my guilt. Let me just give them what they want so I don't create conflict. That's a kind of classic idiot compassion. But in the last few years, as I've been teaching the Compassion Cultivation Protocol at Stanford, I've come to see that there are actually some other really common forms of idiot compassion, some confusions about compassion that are very prevalent both in the general public and in people who come to practice specifically to cultivate compassion. So some of these confusions keep us from wanting to train ourselves because we're maybe a little bit afraid of what will happen if we open ourselves up in this way. And others are confusions that gets in the way once we are in the practice. So the first I should offer to you a definition of compassion that we use at CCARE that can help us think about what compassion is and is not. And so this definition was created as a collaboration between psychologists, neuroscientists, and Tibetan scholars using traditional definitions of compassion. And in this definition, compassion always begins with the recognition of suffering. As I become aware that you are suffering, or I am suffering, or we are suffering. And just from that awareness, from that recognition, that gives rise to some sort of feeling state. And you're probably familiar with this feeling state. It has a kind of rawness to it. We may feel touched in the heart. There's a little bit of distress or stress that goes along with it, but at the same time, a kind of warmth and connection that go together. And that mixed emotional state is actually really important when we think about what compassion is and is not, because when we fall too much into the distress or the stress, it really interferes with our ability to offer compassion. Okay, so we are aware of suffering. It gives rise to a feeling state in our mind and body. And in theory, if everything goes along as planned, that feeling gives rise to a desire to do something to relieve that suffering, to relieve your suffering or my suffering or our suffering, and then a willingness to take action. So four things: awareness, a feeling, a motivation, and then a willingness to take action. And the first form of idiot compassion that I started coming across would always be in the first class when I offer this definition. And there are always individuals who are very strong opinion that we should not have the word suffering in the definition of compassion. And this was unusual to me in the beginning because I was used to talking about compassion in a Buddhist context where, well, we sort of have agreed on the definition, and it's different than loving kindness or equanimity or sympathetic joy. That compassion is about suffering. It's a response to suffering. But I found that many people in our community at large really do not want to touch the suffering aspect, that they come to compassion cultivation because they want to feel love. They want to feel warm and fuzzy about puppies and babies and really feel connected to others, but absolutely not in the context of suffering. And people will argue, really get into it, that why do we need to think about suffering? Isn't it enough just to focus on the positive, happiness and flourishing? That's why do we have to go into that suffering stuff? And I think that that reflects a very common human tendency we all have to find that suffering is something we want to move away from. And yet sometimes we show up for compassion training thinking it's going to bring up just these wonderful loving feelings of connection to others and aren't prepared for the reality of opening ourselves up to suffering and what that feels like. And many people do have a kind of reality check in our first practice when we offer the practice of compassion for a loved one, where you're asked to remember a time when a loved one was suffering and then to go into your body and notice how that feels, notice what thoughts are present, what emotions are present, and to really think about that loved one suffering. And that's the exercise. And many people, when they first do that practice, it is not fun. It doesn't feel loving. It actually, people are overwhelmed with grief, with anxiety, with a compulsion to then have to fix it immediately. And all these things that come up that are like near beer, they're like near compassion. But they're colored so much by distress that there's really no room for the rest of the compassion to arise. The desire to offer support, to offer presence, and to really investigate what would be the most helpful thing to do in that moment. And so this sort of idiot or near compassion emerges that psychologists call sympathetic distress. And there are a lot of people walking around in the world who believe that that's what compassion is. Compassion is this feeling of being overwhelmed in the face of suffering. the sense that I can't handle it, I need to escape it, I need to fix it immediately. I believe that you can't handle it, so I need to fix it, so that nobody here is adequate to the experience that is happening that involves some suffering. And there are a couple of problems if this is what we think compassion is. First is the obvious problem that when you are overwhelmed by your own feelings, our motivation tends to be to want to fix our own distress rather than respond to the situation skillfully. So it interferes. But also, who wants to cultivate that? Who wants to cultivate sympathetic distress? And so the first thing that wise compassion requires is the recognition that compassion often involves emotion regulation. We talk a lot in Buddhism about compassion practices opening the heart. And yet a lot of people are walking around with their hearts not so open, not because they don't know what it's like to open their heart, but that they've had the experience when they open it, they are so flooded by feelings and by distress and anxiety and grief, that they close it back down. And so what we often need to do is strengthen the container that is going to hold this experience of compassion and that is spacious enough to be present with the suffering of others. And so to help cultivate this kind of wise compassion, we often need to learn how to move away from those first feelings that arise in the face of suffering and get very grounded in a discrete sense of self. And some of the studies that look at who it is that is able to help in an emergency situation or who it is that chooses to stay and interact with someone who is suffering versus who decides to leave early and not want to engage. When you look at what's happening in their brain, one of the things that you see is activation of areas of the brain that create a distinction between self and other. And this is something we really don't talk about much in Buddhism, that especially we heard earlier that this no-self stuff is slippery. And this is one of the ways that the idea of no-self is slippery. It's not so much that we want to completely fuse with what is happening, be completely fused with the suffering of the other so that we drown in it, that there needs to be a sense that we are contained in our own body so that we can then choose to relate to what is happening. And so the first practices that we do for cultivating wise compassion is learning how when that distress arises, when you're in the presence of someone who's in pain or who is in grief or who is angry, that you go to your own body and your own breath and create that sense of groundedness that provides a kind of strength for the heart so that it then can open with support within that container. Okay. How about the next form of idiot compassion? The next one is the one that tends to launch the most arguments, which makes for very fun classes. And this is the idiot conception of compassion as a kind of unfair giving up of everything that is yours, giving up all of your own beliefs, giving up the ability to distinguish between right and wrong, and becoming some kind of overexposed, overvulnerable martyr. For example, people are worried that if we come in and cultivate compassion, and we talk about broadening our compassion, what does that mean? A lot of people fear that it means that I'm going to have to give away everything that I have physically and energetically to others, and there will be no one left to uniquely care about me. And that brings up a lot of fear, that if I'm opening up to others, there can be a sense that who's going to do that in return for me? And do I need to give up my own ability to be that person for myself? And that can keep a lot of people from engaging with these practices because there is that fear. Wise compassion teaches us, actually, this is part of life, that we have special obligations and special duties to those we are close to, including ourselves. We would not have evolved a capacity to care for others and to help others without some sort of anchoring to those we are uniquely responsible to care for, ourselves, our children, our offspring, our communities, and our neighbors. And so one of the first things that we teach when we're moving into broadening compassion is that the system doesn't work if you don't have that special sense of closeness or compassion for those you are responsible to. And broadening compassion doesn't mean that everyone is equal and that you need to give all your money to Africa because they're suffering more than your kids. You can't send them to college. Instead, you have to, you know, ship it all out where the suffering is greatest. And so, you know, the idiot who doesn't want to open up because there's a sense of then losing the capacity to care for oneself or close others, that's something that can really get in the way. Another concern that people often have is that broadening compassion means having to approve of, accept, and forgive people who do harm to others. And there's always that exception, right? And usually it starts, if we're talking about it, it'll start with Hitler. It'll start with, like, the really hard ones, Osama bin Laden. And then it ends up being your mother-in-law or the coworker who chews gum too loudly. But there's somebody who is just outside of the human family. They're just outside, and we just need to keep them out because there is no way compassion could possibly apply to this person who creates so much suffering. And so the idiot compassion says, compassion is okay as long as I get to narrowly define who gets it, and I don't have to invite into the circle of compassion all of those people who I think create suffering. Never mind how many people think I'm that person, but we'll keep all those people out. And so one of the most important things we teach of moving towards a wiser view of compassion is that whatever seeds are giving rise to those destructive acts, whether it's harming others, abusing others, violence, prejudice, all of those things, the seeds themselves, the hate, the anger, the personal shame that makes us want to reassert our status, the loneliness, all of those things that give rise to destructive acts, that is by definition suffering. And so that when we wish these people to be free from suffering, whoever it is you would put in that, who's in that category these days? Anyone want to offer up? Or we're in a church, we can't do that. Is that? Bernie Madoff was coming up a lot in the last year. Whoever it is that you would put in that category and say, absolutely no, this person is not, they're just not deserving of compassion. To recognize that that person is by definition suffering by whatever is giving rise to their destructive acts or their abusive acts. And that's a type of wisdom that is taught in Buddhism but can be difficult for people to connect to, because we may choose to narrowly define suffering as remorse. That, you know, until that Bernie Madoff, or whoever it is, until they are writhing with remorse and regret and guilt and shame over what they did, they're not suffering yet, and I'm not going to wish them be free from suffering until I see evidence that they've suffered in that way. And of course, that's the idiot who believes that I'm going in any way benefit from seeing them suffer, not recognizing that any pleasure I would take from even that version of suffering is suffering itself too. And so we teach this practice of broadening the circle by wishing, may we all be free from the suffering. So when there are people who are so hard to open our hearts to recognize that whatever is producing that system that we're a part of, whatever end of the system we're on, creating the suffering, receiving the suffering, the victim, the doer, we're all suffering. And to wish, may we all be free from this. And to find a very expansive definition of both suffering and compassion that allows us to step back a little bit from wanting to exclude people. And so many ways, cultivating a wise compassion instead of an idiot compassion is not so much about feeling the love and that special warmth to the people who are our strangers or in our minds the enemy. It's about learning just to disidentify a little bit from the inner experiences like prejudice and discrimination, hostility, schadenfreude, those things that are really the antithesis of compassion. And we don't need to cultivate any special closeness, but just simply allow the inner experiences of hate and hostility to dissolve. And that is really the type of wisdom that allows us to act with compassion and also with discrimination, so that we may choose to send somebody to jail who is a danger to society and view that as an act of compassion for everyone who's involved. And in fact, one of the studies that was done at SeaCare with the compassion cultivation training program was looking at how people who went through this training program reacted to someone who was in prison for killing someone. And people who had gone through the compassion meditation training were much more positive in their interactions with this inmate. And yet afterwards, when they were asked, "Do you think this person deserves the life sentence?" they were more likely than people who hadn't gone through the training to think, yeah, they deserve the sentence that they got, the life sentence. So they were both sort of more human in their interactions with this person, and yet at the same time, able to see that there are consequences for actions, and this may be the best for all involved to have this person in jail. And so that's the kind of wise compassion that we are aspiring toward. So the last type of idiot compassion that I want to mention has to do with what is, for most people, the most difficult form of compassion, and that is self-compassion. And there is definitely a strong group of people, and whenever we bring people together who want to cultivate compassion, who would exclude themselves from that circle, that compassion is for everyone else except for me. And partly that's because we don't have really good models for what self-compassion is. Even if we understand what it's like to relate to someone who is suffering with mindfulness, with acceptance, without judgment, and the willingness to do something, maybe we know what that's like for others. We've never done that for ourselves, and we never really get a chance to see others doing that for themselves. And so we have this idiot conception of self-compassion, maybe as self-pity. And you may have thrown a few self-pity parties for yourself, where you just wallow in the suffering, and especially the story of it. Why did this happen to me? This was so unfair. Let me play it in my mind 5 more times, and I'll just exaggerate some of the details a little bit so I really feel how awful it was. Maybe I'll tell people about it and how unfair it is and how it should have been. And that, you know, sometimes we enjoy that. I mean, sometimes there's a little bit of ego or a little bit of social connection that comes from that. But mostly we just feel worse when we do that. And so when we're asked to feel compassion for ourselves, many people rightly think, you know, I don't want to wallow in my suffering in that way, and maybe even fear that they're going to get lost in it. Some people describe this kind of feeling of a black hole of suffering, and they're afraid if they turn their attention to it, they're just going to fall into it and not be able to get out. So that's not self-compassion. And then other people are really well practiced in self-indulgence as a kind of near self-compassion that really doesn't have the same effect. So, you know, we might say to ourselves, oh gosh, it was so uncomfortable to meditate tonight. I'm not going to come back next week. Those chairs were too stiff. And it's going to be better for me to watch TV instead on a nice, cozy couch at home, right? Or, you know, those carrots didn't taste as good as the carrot cake. I'm going to be good to myself and eat carrot cake, you know, for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. This kind of self-indulgence, as if anything that requires any effort from us, anything that's not immediately gratifying, that is suffering. And so we're going to give in to our immediate needs as a way of being kind or compassionate to ourselves. And many people rightly don't want to head in that direction either. And so they'll say, I don't want to cultivate self-compassion. I know me. If I do that, I'm never going to get off the couch. I need to be strict with myself. I need to be hard on myself. Otherwise, I'm going to turn into this absolutely terrible version of myself. And there's a real lack of self-trust, a real lack of knowing who you are, and that you actually can trust yourself a little more than that. So we have these two extremes of idiot self-compassion, the self-pity, the wallowing in our own suffering, and the self-indulgence, where we try to protect ourselves, cocoon ourselves off from any inconvenience or discomfort. What self-compassion really is, the wise self-compassion, is exactly what it is for other people. That self-compassion begins with recognition of your own suffering and perhaps noticing what it feels like in your body, what thoughts are present, what disappointments are present, what emotions are present, and allow yourself to have that experience and trust that you have a little bit of inner strength or a lot of inner strength to hold that experience. Just like you don't collapse in the face of other suffering, you trust that you will not collapse in the face of your own suffering, which is what we're training with mindfulness. You know, whether you were trusting yourself not to melt in the oppressive heat of this room while you are meditating, or be overly distracted by the sounds outside. You're cultivating this inner strength that whatever rises, I can ride it out. I can literally ride it out with presence. So self-compassion begins with that quality of mindfulness to our own stress and suffering. And then the second element is the one that we really don't have good models for, and that's common humanity. Most of the time, we feel like our suffering separates us from others. That is, it reveals what is uniquely wrong with us. This happened because I'm stupid, I'll never change, nobody loves me, whatever. Okay, so this reveals what's uniquely wrong with us. Or we believe we're the only ones going through this. Nobody knows what this pain feels like except for me. No one's heart's ever been this broken. No one's ever endured this kind of physical pain. No one's ever worked so hard and then not gotten what they wanted. And of course, I was thinking the AA meeting that was happening while we were meditating is such a perfect relief to this self-isolation with suffering, to know, just like me, actually, you know what sadness is like. You know what pain is like. Am I right? You know what anger is like? Do you know what anxiety is like? And so to find a way to recognize that whatever suffering you're experiencing in this moment, that it is what connects you to other people, not what isolates you from other people. And in a few moments, we're going to do a practice that helps us experience that. So that's the second aspect of self-compassion. And the third aspect is self-kindness, which again is not the same thing as that near self-kindness of self-indulgence. And it's just like what we need to do when we are extending compassion to others. So just like you would not give the drug addict who wants to quit, you don't help them shoot up just because they're going through withdrawal. You yourself take a good, honest look at what can be done in this moment to move you back in the direction of your values, of your goals, of the relationships that matter to you, whatever it is that you are aspiring to in a very positive and heartfelt way. How do you point yourself back in that direction and say what you need to say to yourself, do what you need to do, or call for the support you need to get back and re-engage with life when suffering often it encourages us to disengage from life? So mindfulness of suffering, common humanity, and self-kindness. And so what I want to do now, since that tends to be the practice that people find the most sort of confusing or unused to in everyday life, we're going to do a very short practice, about 5 minutes, that we use in the Stanford Compassion Cultivation Training Program. So you get a feeling for what that is. And I personally have found that this practice of everything we teach in the training and everything that I've learned from my teachers in the tradition, this has been the most powerful for myself in helping me deal with my own suffering, and also staying open to the suffering of others. So if you'd like to readjust your seat. So if you're leaning back, it can be good to be a little bit further back in the chair so that the belly feels open and the heart feels open as you lean back. Or you can be a little bit more forward and perched up. And place your hands in whatever position feels like you are opening yourself up to this experience or grounding yourself in the present moment. And then you can bring your awareness to the head and neck. Maybe take a little chin nod up and down. And it can be nice to let the chin relax down while still lifting up through the crown of the head and feel that length all along the spine up through the crown of the head. Okay, so keeping that length in your spine, you might lift your shoulders up to your ears if they're not there already, and then with an exhale, drop them down and let them rest there. Feel free to close your eyes for this brief practice or drop your gaze to your own lap or in front of you. Bring some awareness to the breath as it enters and exits the body. Let's take a few breaths, inhaling through the nose and then relaxing the jaw and exhaling through the mouth, just letting the breath exit the body. Very easy. Inhaling through the nose, relaxing the jaw and exhaling through the mouth. Take one more breath in that way. Now continue to inhale and exhale through the nose as that is comfortable. Let the mind drop into how it feels to breathe. Feel the relaxation in your forehead. Feel the relaxation around the eyes. Feel the relaxation around your jaw and lips. And again, let your mind settle into how it feels to breathe. I'd like you to notice that when you breathe in, there's some expansion that is happening in your body. It's already happening, guaranteed. Find the feeling of expansion as you breathe in, and that expansion dissolving as you breathe out. Find the feeling of expansion as you breathe in, and expansion dissolving as you breathe out. Now bring your awareness to the center of your chest, around your physical heart and lungs. And I'd like you to imagine that you could inhale and exhale directly through the center of your chest as if you had moved your nostrils there. A little shortcut. Imagine that you could inhale directly into the heart and lungs and exhale directly out from the lungs and the heart through the center of your chest. And just go for the feeling of this. Can you place the feeling of expansion into the area around the heart and lungs? Inhaling into the heart and exhaling from the heart. And keep this basic feeling of the breath. But now also bring to mind something that is creating some stress, some physical pain, or some emotional pain in your life. Bring to mind something that in your own life, it can be very minor, paper cuts hurt too, or something quite overwhelming. But bring to mind something specific. And notice how you feel when you think about this. As you think about this, are there any sensations present in your body that weren't there a moment ago? Or are there any particular thoughts racing through your head now? Can you take a moment to acknowledge the difficulty of this situation? That it is perfectly reasonable that in the situation you would be stressed or in pain or in some way suffering. And I'd like you to consider the possibility that whatever this experience is in your life, that it does not isolate you from others, but that there are countless other people right now in this moment around the world who know what this feels like, who are going through something very similar in their own lives. Just contemplate the truth of that statement. There are countless other people on the planet right now who are also going through this type of experience. perhaps there's a sense of compassion that naturally arises when you consider this. And so now I'd like you to imagine that on the inhalation, you could just breathe in this experience. That as you imagine breathing in right into the center of your chest, that you could open your heart to the experience that you are having. As you inhale, imagine you could literally just breathe into the reality of this situation. And as you exhale from the heart, from the center of the chest, imagine that you are sending out compassion, not just for yourself, but for everyone else in this moment who is sharing this type of pain or suffering. And we'll take this practice for about a minute. As you inhale, imagine breathing into your heart just an openness to this experience. And as you exhale, imagine sending out from the heart compassion for yourself and for all others who are sharing in this experience. And now silently recite in your own mind, may we all be free from this suffering. May we all be free from this suffering. May we each find peace. May we each find peace. And in your own mind, you might consider, may my own willingness to open my heart to this experience in my own life, may that in some way contribute to the courage, to the peace, to the freedom from suffering of all of the other people who are suffering in this way. May my own willingness to open my heart to this experience, may that in some way contribute to the courage, to the peace of all others who are suffering in this moment. And then bring your awareness back to the simple sensations of the breath. Notice that you're breathing in and out. Bring awareness back to the whole body, to your feet on the earth, to your hands in your lap, to the strength of your spine. If your eyes are closed, go ahead and open your eyes. Have a sense of opening back up to the space around you. And then just move or stretch in any way that feels needed after being still for a few minutes. So that practice is an example of both self-compassion and the Tibetan practice of Tonglen, of taking in suffering and offering out compassion. And it's a way that we can use our own suffering as a springboard for cultivating compassion for others. So I hope that perhaps that gives you both a sense of what why is compassion that we're here for, what that might look like or feel like in action, and maybe gives you a practice that you can take with you. So we have a couple of minutes left for observations, comments, experiences, or questions. And it doesn't have to be a question. Was that a little hand raiser? Nope. Yes. Moved by the suffering that we see, what do you do when it knocks you down? In psychology, we have a couple of words that describe this experience that I think actually really give us a sense of how embodied this is. One is compassion fatigue. Is when we are exposed to a great deal of suffering in our own life or in others, whether you're a professional caregiver, a rescue worker, a teacher in medicine, or if you are a caregiver for someone in your own life, or even if you just watch the news, right? that we can be exposed to so much suffering that we feel drained in the presence of suffering, that we feel inadequate to the degree of suffering we're exposed to, that our own resources don't match the amount of suffering that we feel. Another word that's used in psychology is compassion collapse. And that's where there's such a flood of feeling that the whole system shuts down. It's instead of being a kind of wise form of emotion regulation that lets us stay grounded, the brain says, way too much. I'm flooded with feelings I don't know how to act on. I don't know what to do. So I'm going to turn off the inner generator of compassion, and I'm going to feel nothing. And the research suggests that the more compassion we see, the more our compassion collapses, including things like watching the news. So first, just to give sort of a label to what we're often dealing with, the sense of fatigue, of overwhelm, and sometimes collapse, where we no longer feel anything in response to suffering. Yes, and that is the primary symptom of... Yes. So that is a sort of primary symptom of the compassion fatigue, that we feel like we are drowning in our own feelings of compassion and empathy and often grief, and that we feel inadequate to respond. So the main practices that we teach for compassion fatigue and for that sense of being overwhelmed by our own emotions to the point of depression or to the point of anxiety, one is the one you guys are already practicing as a group, is stabilizing the mind with attention to breath and body. And to do that when you don't need it, so that you have it when you need it. And when you start to feel the floodgates of feelings that that make you want to withdraw or that make you despair, to have a practice of stabilizing yourself with awareness of the breath and the body that is creating that strong container. And to think of that as being the primary resource for handling difficult emotions. And often in the moment, what is required is that little bit of emotion regulation where you turn your attention away from the distress and despair and refocus back on the suffering that is outside of yourself. And so we also train things like visual attention, that learning to attend to what is happening in the present moment. So if I'm starting to feel overwhelmed by your suffering, that is, I need to actually train my attention now back onto you when my own inner emotions are really fighting for my attention. I may need skills in regulating the physiology of stress, certain breathing techniques, and that there are these resources we build so that we learn how to actually turn down a little bit the affective or emotional component or the overwhelm. The other core practice is self-compassion. And one of the most interesting studies that I've seen is looking at people who are naturally compassionate for others and have actually chosen as their career to do something that is compassionate, whether teaching or rescue working. And the study found that on average they spent less than 1 hour a week doing things that could be described as self-care, whether that's exercise or creative activity that brings you joy, or spending time doing something that is nourishing and replenishing. And that people who are really attuned to the suffering of others were spending on average less than an hour a week restoring themselves and giving themselves a break from the being responsible only for other people's suffering. So that's another sort of set of responses that we encourage people to do, that when you start to find yourself feeling depressed by how much suffering is going on around you, to start to create systems of support for yourself so that you have both strength and energy to give. So those are sort of some of the things, and it's not like there's an easy answer. But part of this gets at this idea, I keep remembering Mathieu Ricard, who is a monk who teaches on compassion. And he said, the thing that is wrong with you Westerners is you think compassion is a feeling. Compassion is a mindset that leads to action. And don't get confused about the feeling part. Because and it's true, in the West, we are very, emotions. There's anger, there's sadness, and there's this compassion. And what he was saying is we really need to train in the other aspects of compassion. If we get too identified with the emotional aspect of it, sometimes we fail to act when the emotion isn't present. but we also may fail to cultivate the skills we need to actually downregulate the emotional part and refocus on the action part. That was a very long answer. I was asked to be very mindful of time and end on time, but I'm not going to send, and it's time to end. I'm not going to run off immediately. So if you have other questions or comments or observations, I'm going to stick around. Thank you very much for your attention. The CCARE program, if you're interested, the website is ccare.stanford.edu. And I don't know if folks here would put that on a website or something, or I don't know if you have an email list, but it's C, like the letter C, and then CARE, C-A-R-E, ccare.stanford.edu. And we offer these training programs to the public that go through traditional Tibetan practices in cultivating mind stability, loving kindness, and compassion, including some of the stuff I talked about tonight. We do not have a public course beginning immediately, but we are continually rolling them out. And we do have some public courses starting in Berkeley. If you like to drive or you know friends in the East Bay, there are a couple of public programs that are starting soon. So that's how to find out about that if you're interested. I have taught a version of it through continuing education, but not the full formal protocol. Actually, we're going to be bringing it to the VA is the next place we're launching it. And if you know any undergraduates at Stanford, we are offering it to undergraduates this quarter. And there will be other classes for folks who are interested at other times. First, let me correct something that I may have missaid or you may have misheard. We don't disidentify from the person. We disidentify from the inner experience of hate, judgment, hostility, anger, and dehumanization. So what we're learning to disidentify from is all the stuff in here that is saying this person is not deserving of compassion. That's what we really train to disidentify from. We actually learn how to stay in relationship with the people. And one of my favorite teachings on this is the idea of wrathful compassion. That is, when you have disidentified from the inner states of hate and anger and fear, all the stuff that gives rise to unskillful behavior, that when you disidentify from that, it is much easier to see what is going to be skillful in the situation to make sure that that person is less destructive to themselves and to others. And that the first step is about shifting the place that you're coming from so that you can re-engage with the situation in a skillful way. And so that the idea of wrathful compassion is that you will be willing to take action to prevent suffering, even if it makes some people unhappy. But it has to come from a place of true compassion, that if it starts from the wrath, you're just going to be, you know, or you feel like you need to escape the situation immediately. I have to quit my job because I can't stand this person. Or I have to, you know, leave the country when the election doesn't go the way I want or whatever. So thank you for that and for letting me correct something I may have missaid. Have a good night.